Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bokomi. The OMI in Bokomi stands for the original memorable insights that we find when we connect with books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. And every week, we ask someone at the top of their industry or profession to pick a book from our most wanted list of new non-fiction. This week, our guest leader is the co-founder of a global community for smart-minded women.
Hello, Bokomi. I'm Debbie Wasko. I'm the co-founder of Albright, and I want to read Robin Dunbar's book, Friends, because as the founder of a club where people come together in a physical space that stands for something, I want to understand friendship better and the importance that friendship can have on our lives and on our human relationships and on our health. And off the back of a year where we have not been able to convene as friends in physical spaces, I want to understand what that means for me, what that means for Albright's community of smart-minded, ambitious women, and what we can do differently.
Thank you, Debbie Wasko.
Professor Robin Dunbar leads the Social and Evolutionary Neuroscience Research Group at Oxford University and has dedicated his career to exploring and explaining the human social world, possibly, he says, the most complex phenomenon in the observed universe.
The social skills we need to handle this extraordinarily complex and dynamic and constantly changing social universe we live in as adults requires years and years of intense practice and learning.
About 30 years ago, Professor Dunbar became famous for observing the social life of primates to come up with the number 150. Dunbar's number, no less. That's the maximum number of private, personal, stable relationships that you, with your human brain, can manage and maintain in your life and your work.
Robin, welcome to Bokomi.
Thank you for having me.
Ever since you discovered your eponymous number 150, almost 30 years ago, if you don't mind explaining, you've probably done this a lot more than 150 times. How did you come up with the number 150 in the first place? And crucially, what new insights did you uncover in the writing of this book?
Discovery of Dunbar's number was completely serendipitous and accidental in that a very long time ago, it seems now, I was trying to see whether the size of social groups in primates, which is what I mainly worked on in those days, correlated with the size of their brains. And indeed, they did. A very nice relationship. And since it was probably about 3 a.m. at that point, I started idly speculating what that might imply for humans. It's just simply a matter of finding the equivalent brain size for humans, plugging it into the equation and seeing what it gave us. And it gave us this number 150, which I thought must be too low. It didn't seem right to me, especially as I was at the time sitting in the middle of London, and clearly there are rather more than 150 people in London. Then sort of occurred to me that, well, maybe the problem was not, if you like, the neighbourhoods we live in, whereas obviously in most of these big cities, the vast majority of the other occupants are complete strangers whom we wouldn't recognise again if we saw them. But this number perhaps had something much more to do with the size of groups within which our species had spent 99%+ of its evolutionary history, and that maybe the place to look was in hunter-gatherer societies. So when I assembled all these together, lo and behold, there was the number 150. It's the average, or was the average size of English villages in the Doomsday Book. The average is very consistently 150 in virtually every county in England. That's 1,000 years ago.
Professor Dunbar, how would you define a friend, and why is having friends important from a biological point of view?
So friends are really best thought of, I think, as those people who would unstintingly come to your aid or agree to do you a favour out of a sense of obligation to you. And that sense of obligation has a history to it. In other words, this is not a stranger in the night that you chance to ask to help you out with some task you had to do, but somebody who had a relationship which has history. And that history is embedded in a network of relationships and friendships, so that one of the kind of underpinning effects is the fact that if they refused to come to your aid in your hour of need, somebody else in the network would be very upset about it and tell them off. There's a sort of self-policing effect built into it, I think. The number of people who do that really seems to be limited to about 150, give or take some variation around that. And the people who lie outside it are much more likely to make a deal on the basis of some exchange. Well, I'll help you out now if you help me out. This 150 includes your extended family, and we do seem to give priority to extended family over friends. Friends seem to be the default that you fill up the empty slots with when you've exhausted your extended family, perhaps for good reasons, because family are the one group of people who will come riding over the hill as the cavalry when everybody else has abandoned you. And it is the case that people who come from big extended families, who have lots and lots of cousins, for example, actually have fewer friends. I mean, they will tell you, you know, well, I don't have that many friends because it takes me all my time, you know, getting around my cousins.
That's a really interesting way of looking at what is right in front of us. I mean, a lot of what you write about and what you study is something which we take for granted, and yet, as you observe, is incredibly complex. And now that you mention it, all the people I know with very strong families or strong family ties seem to have a less wide, a more narrow social network, whereas people I know who've moved away from home or are transient have a huge social network across continents. And they replace the family unit, don't they? So is it down to time then? Is it literally just we literally don't have time for more people?
Two things, really. I mean, it's very clear that there has to be a, if you like, a cognitive element in this. It's not just memory of names and faces, as it were, but it's knowledge about the relationship that you have with a person that seems to be critical. And there seems to be this upper limit on the number of people you can hold in that kind of relationship. It's partly kind of a cognitive information processing issue, but of course it's also partly a kind of emotional raw feels, as you might say, component to it too. They're the people whom you feel kind of a warmth to out of, you know, sort of having had this long history with them in the past when you've done lots of things that we conventionally do with our friends, you know, from having a beer together in the pub to climbing mountains together or whatever is your particular preference. So there is that cognitive element to it, but there is also an important component of time. And what time seems to do really is give structure to this social network. So the 150 really consists of a series of layers of increasingly smaller numbers of people as they come in towards you, but increasingly intense friendships. The quality of a friendship doesn't apply quite so much to family relationships, but the quality of friendships are very sensitive to the actual amount of time you devote to them. So you actually devote about 40% of your total available social time, which amounts to something like 2.5 hours per day or something of that order.
Do you think that social media and Facebook in particular, because you talk about Facebook a lot in the book, that social media might alter our perception of what a friend is? The received wisdom being that we have more friends online than we do in the real world. But you quote studies and surveys in Britain showing that the actual number of friends people have online on Facebook is closer to your number of 150.
Certainly, all the evidence suggests that, notwithstanding the urban myths about many people having 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 friends on Facebook, in reality, that's not true. A few years ago, one of the analysts who does a lot of work for Facebook actually analysed 1 million Facebook pages and counted up the number of friends that each page had. And yes, you know, there are a few people out on the tail end with, let's say, more than 1,000 friends on Facebook. But relatively speaking, it was a very small number. Of course, you know, even a tiny proportion, when you multiply that by a very large number of people on Facebook, means you come across quite a few people with 1,000 or more friends on Facebook. But the vast majority had between about 150 and 250 friends on Facebook. And as you get older, you become more discriminating I think is what happens. And your time gets pressured much more, of course, and you just don't have the time to devote to it. And so you come down sort of by the 30s to the 150. It's very stable after that until post 65, when it starts to fall steadily down towards zero again.
Down to zero.
if you live long enough. Yes. Yes. It'll take a while for that to happen.
So the sign of success. Inexorably it does. The sign of success in life is your Dunbar number going further and further down to zero.
Yes. The vanishing point of oblivion.
Yeah. Well, talking of oblivion, as we do, you describe quite chillingly the evolutionary alarm bell of loneliness that's ringing through society with separation from social groups at school combined as it is now. Do you think kids today will be the lonely generation of tomorrow? Do you think Dunbar's number will get smaller if our brains have less social data to deal with on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I guess this question really goes back to the question of what role social media have played in this whole process and in a sense maintaining our social world. From both our research and from other people's research, the answer seems to be actually social media really doesn't change the structure or the size of your social networks. And indeed, the frequencies with which you contact people on social media, whether it's by phone or by texting or by named postings on Facebook, mirrors exactly the frequencies which you see in the real world. Kind of main benefit that it provides is it slows down the natural rate of decay on friendships that would happen if you couldn't see somebody. So when a friend moves away for some reason, a job or whatever it is, or goes traveling and you can't see them, after some months, the emotional quality of that friendship will inexorably decline. Of course, in everyday life, you simply go around and find somebody else to fill that empty slot. You know, it takes probably about 2 or 3 years for somebody to go from a good friend, perhaps not your best friend, because those very, very close best friend relationships tend to be a bit more stable. They're a bit more like family relationships. But certainly your good friend will kind of eventually end up in the acquaintances circle outside your 150, as somebody you once knew but haven't seen for years and years and years. But that takes about 3 years. But it's quite inexorable. Well, what things like Facebook seem to be able to do very nicely is hold up that rate of decay and prevent that friendship dying quite so quickly. Whether that's a good thing is an interesting question, because the problem with best friends that are on the other side of the world is, you know, you can't go around and knock on their door when your life falls apart to get the kind of emotional support that your friends are there for. And somehow it doesn't work in quite the same sort of way online. But I think the kind of worry here has to do much more with the fact that the social skills we need to handle this extraordinarily complex and dynamic and constantly changing social universe we live in as adults requires years and years of intense practice and learning. Current estimates are that it probably takes you about 25 years, the first 25 years of life, to become a fully functional psychological adult. Before about 25, you crank out the nature of relationships in your conscious brain. You're kind of having to think about them and think about what, you know, what did Jimmy, when Jimmy said X, what did he really mean? And you have to crank through this, and it takes a long time. And you've had enough practice after about 2.5 decades to be able to automate a lot of that. So people older than that tend to process relationships in other parts of the brain below the consciousness horizon. So everything's much more automated, if you like. The lesson from that is that if too much time is spent online, the risk is you don't really learn the skills to handle lots of relationships simultaneously in the way we need to be able to do. And you have to learn those in the sandpit of life. That's how I sometimes describe it. That, you know, when somebody kicks sand in your face, you can't get out of the sandpit. You just have to find ways to deal with it. And that requires these sort of learning, these capacities for compromise and diplomacy and what have you. The risk is then you know, society becomes more fragmented than it already is. Of course, the problem is we're not going to know for a generation whether this is true or not, but by then it's going to be much too late.
Let's talk about sex. How do men and women differ in their ability to form and maintain relationships? And is that a result of nature and biology or nurture and environment?
Yeah, the sex differences that have emerged in the last, probably no more than about 5 years or so, I would say, were a considerable surprise to us. They really left-fielded us completely because we hadn't expected to find them. Although looking back on our data from the previous 20 years, the signals were already there. But they really boil down to the fact that women are much more intensely social than men are. The kind of male social world is in many ways much more anonymous and less focused on individuals than a women's social world. There's an element of kind of out of sight, out of mind in boys' relationships, I think. You know, if your drinking partner goes off to the other side of the world, well, it's a pity, and you sort of shrug your shoulders and you simply go and find somebody else to fill that social slot for you. Whereas girls and women will tend to work very hard at trying to keep those friendships going over distance and over time. Possibly not always a good thing to do, but you know, that's how it is. And this seems to have a lot to do with the fact that there's a real sex difference in how relationships are maintained. Women's friendships are really built up and sort of maintained over time and kept ticking over nicely, really by talking together. So if two friends move apart, what really makes the difference to keeping that friendship going is increasing the opportunities and the amount of time they spend talking to each other directly or you know, by phone or perhaps indirectly via something like Facebook. That, you know, interacting with somebody else is extremely important. Talking together has zero effect on the boys' friendships. And this is because I think what mediates boys' friendships is doing stuff together. It's much more activity-based. It may be just sitting in the pub on a Friday evening having a drink. It may be, you know, the five-a-side Friday night soccer group. It may be climbing mountains, any of those sort of things. But it tends to be much more activity-based. And kind of conversations, blokes talk by definition when they're in groups together in the pub, as it were. But the content of the conversation is much, much less important. And if you ask a woman what they talked about in a group, a small group, she'll be able to tell you in great detail what the conversation is about. If you ask a couple of guys this question, they kind of look blankly at you usually and say, well, we talked about something. And that's kind of because what's involved in these social processes in guys is much more activity-based. There's a lot of banter and a lot of laughter usually. So these do seem to be very deep. I mean, we pick the same signals up in monkeys and apes, the very social monkeys and apes. We pick these signals up very, very early on in childhood. If you look at the structure of human social networks, that's the sort of this 150, what you find is that from the age of as early as 4 or 5, right the way through to 84 or 5, 70% of men's friends and family relations are men, and 70% of women's friends and family relationships are women. And usually the remaining 30% who are of the opposite sex are family members anyway, whom you have little or no choice over. And you see exactly the same split in the very, very social monkeys and apes, the baboons, the chimpanzees, species like that, who are intensely social in the way that humans are intensely social. So these differences between the sexes seem to be very deeply buried. I mean, there's no doubt you can tweak them a little bit here and there, but you'll never sort of eradicate those effects. They'll always be sitting below the surface.
And you say that we've each got a social fingerprint, meaning that our friends may change, but what we give and get from them stays the same. Do you think we should take more responsibility for the people that we allow into our social circles? And how do we do that without being shallow and manipulative.
So this was something else, actually, that caught us seriously left field. We had never, ever anticipated anything like this. But it turns out that each of us allocates our available social time, these 2 to 3 hours each day that you have available for social interaction with friends and family. Each of us allocates them to our various members of our social network in quite different ways. So we have a kind of natural social fingerprint, as it were, in which, you know, perhaps I see, let's say, my best friend 7 times a week, and my second and third best friends perhaps 2 times a week and 1 time a week, in that order. Whereas you might see your best friend 5 times a week, but your second and third best friends you treat more equally, and you see them both 3 times a week each. And so, you know, if you kind of look at how we distribute our time, what emerges is this very, very clear fingerprint. We have no idea what causes that. It's possible it has to do with something like extroversion, introversion dimension of personality, because that particular dimension has a big effect on how you manage your social network, your network of friendships. But this pattern seems to be extremely stable over time, so that should you demote somebody or somebody move away and you can't see them, you actually slot somebody else into their slot and see them at exactly the same frequency that you saw the previous occupant. So that kind of structure of how you allocate your time remains extremely stable over time. Again, we really have no idea why that happens, but it's there and it's extremely robust.
There's a great diagram in the book which very simply and shows and demonstrates how social connections ripple out in concentric circles from 5 to 150 and beyond. Does the intensity of our intimate relationships, or the influence, I suppose, of our relationships have an impact on the world at large, depending on what types of relationships they are?
The short answer is yes, there is, in a curious sort of way, a collective brain in this sense. But this goes back to the fact that the way we build up our friendships, in addition to having this kind of raw feels, emotional component, and the kind of calculating psychological component, where you're trying to evaluate how friends think and feel and try to see the world from their point of view, there's this, what's essentially a cultural or social component, which in a way provides us with a kind of quick and dirty access to how good a friend any particular person, any particular stranger we meet might be. And these are what we refer to as the 7 pillars of friendship. They're kind of 7 dimensions of friendship. They're all essentially cultural. They're rather like a supermarket barcode, which you have on your forehead, or perhaps better still, you actually blurt out when you speak. And this is what we spend most of our time in conversations really evaluating and working with. And these 7 pillars are shared cultural icons in many ways, or preferences, might be a better way of putting it. They're having the same language, or better still, dialect. Having grown up in the same area or nearby, having the same hobbies and interests, having the same worldview, which is a sort of compilation of religious, moral, and political views, having the same musical tastes, and having the same sense of humor. And the more of these boxes you tick with somebody, the stronger the friendship will be in the future, and is over time, the more lasting the friendship will be. And indeed, the more likely that friend is to come to your aid whenever you ask them to help you out in some way. Now, what's interesting about these is they actually seem to identify a very small community. It seems like it's the community you were socialized in. So the one really from your teenage years, where you learned how to be a member of your community. You know all the pubs, you know all the cafes you used to hang out in, you know all the streets, you know a lot of the same people maybe. And you also know how people think in that particular area. And these are really quite small extremely small areas. They really amount to nothing bigger than the village, but they do identify very, very small scale units that create this sense of belonging. Now, what it turns out is each of these seven dimensions provides the basis for creating what we call one-dimensional clubs, which can be very large indeed. So you can form a very large but quite low-level friendship with a large number of people simply by virtue of the fact they share some common interest with you. That membership common interest forms the basis of not just a friendship that probably won't last terribly long, but it also allows you to form the basis of a very, very large scale association, and is one of the reasons why religions seem to work so well in this context, even if you share nothing in common with somebody other than that you both belong to the same religion. There is a bond there which wouldn't otherwise exist.
Is there strength in diversity of friendships? Because with the seven pillars, what you're saying in the book seems to be that birds of a feather flock together. We tend to pick the same type of people. We look for similar interests, similar backgrounds, similar beliefs. But does that make our social networks weaker or stronger? And by stronger or weaker, I mean more resilient, more sustainable, more emotionally fulfilling. Are we doing ourselves a disservice by only mixing with people like ourselves?
That's very hard to say. I'm inclined to say it's probably a disservice as much as anything else. But the problem is this effect seems to be very deep-rooted. One of the most consistent findings about friendship is this phenomenon known as homophily, liking the same, birds of a feather flocking together. And this comes out really in this seven pillars of friendship phenomenon. And of course, the seven pillars are cultural. They're things that we characterize a particular community at a particular time in our life, primarily. That's where we learn them, as it were. And that sort of sense of home, in that sense, never seems to leave most people. If you find somebody that lives in the same place as you or lived in the same place as you, there is almost always some kind of bond straight away there. But it extends far beyond that. There's this very striking gender-based homophily. There's a very striking personality-based homophily. Extroverts tend to prefer extroverts. Introverts tend to prefer introverts. Dare I say it, doctors tend to prefer doctors. Lawyers tend to prefer lawyers. You name it, so it goes on. But that's, in a way, what these are all important for, as much as anything, is the flow of conversation. It gives you stuff to talk about, which are common interests, and allow you to keep the relationships constantly building. Of course, what happens with the seven pillars, because they're cultural, you and your friends grow together, if you like, and you know, you discover new comedians to go and see, or new theatre performances to go and see, or develop new philosophical ideas together. Or somebody will introduce a new idea to a group of friends, and so that little group of friendships tends to move together through the cultural space. And conversely, if you separate and don't see each other for a long time, when you come back again, you kind of wonder why you were friends originally at all, because you don't seem to have anything in common anymore. And that's simply because you've met new people, you've been exposed to new ideas and so on over time, and so you've drifted apart. It's a sad reflection in many ways of the fact that we have difficulty handling enormous intellectual complexity, I think, at the best of times. We're astonishingly narrow-minded as a species, despite, you know, the achievements of our big brains. But I think this just goes back to the fact that it's much easier to build friendships when you have a lot of things in common with people. Conversely, it means if you move somewhere else and go to a different country or something, you can learn the new culture relatively quickly and become well embedded in a new set of friendship. But it does tend, I think, to create echo chambers and silos within all cultures. This is not, you know, sort of peculiar to the modern world in any sense or particular countries. It's just a sort of phenomenon that has existed for a long time, because these friendships are designed to create very tightly bonded groups of people who will come to each other's aid precisely because they have this sense of belonging to a very small scale community. That there is a kind of totem pole in the center of the village green on which we can all hang our hats and say, you know, this is who we are. This is why we belong together. And communities that have that really do work better together. And there's no question about that. The big trick, if you like, is how to get all these little village communities that effectively the modern nation state or even the global world working together on a grander scale. And that has to do clearly with kind of finding some basis for a common worldview, which is one of the seven pillars. And it's the skill in finding that that will determine, you know, whether we succeed or don't succeed to create a well-integrated global planet, or whether we constantly break up into, I guess, warring factions in different parts of the world.
That's the problem, isn't it? That that sense of community, that belonging, that tribalism, which is what we're talking about, really, is exploited rather than built upon. That the common feeling, the common human fear of fear, say, or fear or threat to the tribe or threat to the village or threat to the family, is joined together in other threats in one belief system and turned against the greater good. So as a humanist, do you think we're any closer to understanding our role in the universe than we were 30 years ago?
I think over historical time, let's push it a bit further back than 30 years to give it a bit more perspective. We've got better at these things. 2,000 years ago, you had the Roman Empire, which in some senses managed to achieve something along the same lines in the sense of unifying a large geographical area and many different cultures into a kind of unified way of thinking. I mean, it didn't survive, which is, you know, the object lesson of history, really. Empires don't survive. They eventually break up, and they break up from within, usually, not from threats from outside. It's not an insoluble problem. It's something we have to kind of learn to adapt to. Now, in many ways, the archetypal example of this is actually religion. So, you know, we have the big, what are known as world religions, spread all over the globe. But all of these constantly face the same problem, and that is this bubbling up from underneath of cults and sects that destabilize the overarching religion. And sometimes these spin off and become major religions in their own right, as Christianity did out of Judaism, for example. But they all suffer from this problem. And it's, you know, they've been struggling with it for a very long time. They've never found a perfect solution to this, in the sense that being too draconian, as the Catholic Church, for example, has sometimes tried to be, through things like the Inquisition, of imposing theological discipline, kind of never works, because the bubbling up from underneath is a small scale community issue of the nature of our sociality as much as anything else. But on the other hand, they've been modestly successful in being able to create some degree of coexistence with these fractionating effects that they're always subject to. And I think, you know, there is something to be learned out of that, in the sense that it requires a degree of tolerance and a degree of the skills which we need to manage even our personal social relationships, these skills of compromise and diplomacy and so on, which allow us to maintain our friendship circles. They just need scaling up. And the great risk is always factions develop in places which become so hard set that they end up creating what amounts to a civil war. If you look at the history of religion, if you look at the history of any political empire or any geographical area throughout the history of the globe, this is the problem they've constantly been trying to cope with, often very unsuccessfully. You know, we see the same problem in business. And business creates the problem for themselves by sort of agglomerating and buying up other businesses, and you create these enormous conglomerates which eventually fall apart because the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, and you end up in sort of disasters and trouble. But the successful businesses are the ones that have a sense of purpose that everybody signs up to, a sense of family, very often, and very often they are family-run businesses. But these lessons are hard learnt, and it's very easy to lose sight of them, and very easy for silo effects and echo chamber effects to spring up and destabilize the whole system.
Well, Robin, I've spent a bit of time with you in my head and online today. I can't claim to be your close friend after that, but I hope that somewhere in your outer circles I now exist, and that we would say hello to each other on the street. Thanks for sharing your OMI with Bokomi today.
Well, it's been a great pleasure and great fun to do. And yes, I'm very happy to have you and bring you in towards the centre of my world.
Robin's book, Friends, Understanding the Power of Our Most Important Relationships, is available to buy now in the Bokomi section of Primrose Hill Books. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. And if you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our monthly Most Wanted email at bokomi.com. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Be smart, be safe, and remember, when it comes to friendships, quality beats quantity every time. Bye for now.